much of the Midwest. Overnight low temperatures will range from the low 30s across northern Wisconsin to the mid 40s across western Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny, the high 55. The wind from the northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low of 32. The wind will be light and out of the east. Tomorrow, sunny, look for a high of 60. The wind from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly clear, not so cool. We'll see a low of 42. The wind will be from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Sunday, mostly sunny and breezy. The high will be in the low 60s with the wind out of the south from 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 30 miles per hour. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and a low around 50. Monday, cloudy with a chance of showers and a high in the upper 50s. Monday night and Tuesday, mostly cloudy with another chance of showers. The low Monday night in the low 50s, the high Tuesday in the mid-60s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the upper 40s to the mid-50s, most locations reporting sunshine. At Rockford, O'Hare, and Mattoon, it was 50 degrees. In Bloomington and Carbondale, 49 degrees. At South Bend and Lafayette, it was 49 degrees at the top of the hour. Indianapolis reported a temperature of 52. Terre Haute, 53. Evansville, 54. Willard Airport reported a sunny sky at the top of the hour, 48 degrees. The dew point, 38. The relative humidity, 68%. The wind out of the northeast at 12 with gusts to 20. And the barometric pressure, 30.29 and steady. And at 12:39, 50 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The sky is sunny. With Greece in flux over whether it will remain in the Eurozone, other weak economies like Spain are feeling the heat. The worst could be yet to come in Spain, not because of public debt, but because its banks are still laden with unpaid real estate loans, putting both the banks and the housing market in jeopardy. Lauren Freyer reports from Madrid.
Scrolling through real estate ads in the Spanish capital can be sobering. Prices are still very high, even as salaries are frozen and unemployment soars. When Ireland's housing bubble burst, prices there dropped more than 40%. But here it's 18% on average. To understand why, take a look at who actually owns the property. It's the banks. With an average of 300 foreclosures a day nationwide, Spanish banks own lots of property, and they haven't yet written off the losses.
You're not talking about it just so as not to provoke fear.
Gail Allard is an economist at Madrid's IE Business School.
Housing prices have hardly fallen. And what that tells you is that, you know, the banks are just hanging on to those assets and not unloading them, because the minute they do, their balance sheets are really going to look bad. You know, the value of housing will really collapse. And it hasn't happened yet.
What's frightening, Allard says, is that Spain has not yet hit rock bottom in this crisis, not until the banks reckon their losses. When EU leaders in Brussels look southward across Europe, they tend to cringe most at sovereign debt. Countries like Greece, Portugal, and Ireland that can no longer afford to service their loans. Spain, by contrast, has much lower government debt, Allard says.
And the problem with Spain is private debt. And that's what's weighing down on the banks and the part that might not get repaid.
Álvaro Nadal is the economy secretary for Spain's Popular Party, which is forecast to win national elections on November 20th. He says EU leaders are wrong to focus on banks' vulnerability to Greek debt. He wants broader help from Brussels to keep Spain's banks afloat.
If it's a general capitalization and each country can use it to solve the internal problem, domestic problems they've got, for example, real estate in the case of Spain, sovereign debt in other countries, okay. But the exercise we are doing right now in Brussels is just thinking about sovereign debt, and that's what has been mistaken.
This past week, Spain's central bank warned of troubled exposure to real estate. Many mortgages and loans to real estate developers are only now coming due. Defaults are on the rise. Already 7% of all bank loans in Spain go unpaid. Allard explains what that means for Spanish banks' survival.
Big banks I think should be okay. It's the small ones, these savings banks, who have so many of their assets in mortgage loans that they're going to be scrambling to try to keep them propped up.
Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero said his government will help small banks restructure if needed. But the Spanish election is about 2 weeks away. Zapatero isn't running, and the opposition Conservative Party has a double-digit lead in the polls. Spain's banks may be on the precipice, but any action to save them will likely have to wait until after the election. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
After 8 years of renovations, the Islamic galleries at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art have reopened. The 15 rooms of the new galleries for the art of the Arab lands, Turkey, Iran, Central Asia, and later South Asia, consist of some 1,200 objects from a rotating collection of thousands. NPR's Margot Adler has more.
Some of the things in this overwhelming installation you might expect. Many others are surprising, at least to a layman. There is as much secular art here as religious. The written word, as you might expect, is central, and there are extraordinary examples of calligraphy and painting and pottery. Navina Haider is one of the curators of the Islamic department. Writing, she says,
it's sort of the quintessential and highest form of artistic expression in the Islamic world, and also the most binding thread, in one sense, artistically, between all the diverse places and cultures and types of media that you see.
There's a page from what may be the world's largest Quran, as tall as an adult. But in a room that many people enter first, filled with masterpieces from the collection, there's a 10th century bowl from Iran, white glaze with black letters, so pure and simple and yet abstract, it could be a piece of modern art. And here's a surprise. Images are everywhere. Animals, dragons, flowers, realistic paintings of people, a painting of a bat with one wing folded, even architectural images on a prayer rug. Our notion of Islam as forbidding imagery is not quite correct, says Haidar. Yes, in the purely religious sphere, images are discouraged.
But they appear widely outside that context, especially when it comes to the illustration of books and poetry and literature.
The 15 rooms that comprise the renovated galleries, which now bear the unwieldy title, The Art of the Arab Lands, Turkey, Iran, Central Asia, and later South Asia, are arranged to highlight the diversity and interconnectedness of these different cultures, as well as their connection to cultures we might not think are connected, Roman, Chinese, European. The galleries show 13 centuries of works from different cultures, Spain to Turkey, Iran to India.
So you don't get the sense of a single monolith, but you get the sense of a very faceted world with many, many dimensions to it.
The confluence of these cultures is everywhere. For example, a little bowl from China, 12th or 13th century, with a fish at the base in a circular pattern. And next to it, a bowl from Iran with exactly the same pattern. But the most startling thing about the galleries is their beauty. For example, in the carpet room, filled with Ottoman Empire masterpieces, every carpet is individually lit, but everything else remains dark.
There's a sense of mystery, I guess I would say, in this room for the eye, because the eye can't quite tell where the light is coming from or what the logic of the light is, but it's there, and it adds to a kind of certain atmospheric effect, I think, in this room.
There are so many carpets here. We are immediately in a situation where sound has been muffled. There are a sizable number of people here, and yet it doesn't sound the way the rest of the exhibit sounds.
I think there's also something, the power of these objects, the colors, the patterns, and the fact that you are completely enveloped in this room in a world of stars, medallions, and interlocking forms, all in these beautiful, warm colors. It takes you instantly into a kind of another sphere.
There is something very meditative about this space. There's something compelling about the use of architecture here as well. There are wooden carved window screens that filter light into certain rooms and allow shadows to play on the floor. If the sun is not streaming in, you can look through the screen out into the Roman court below, allowing another sense of interconnection. Then there is the Moroccan courtyard with a little fountain and places to sit. There were even rose petals in the water the day I visited. The columns are Spanish from the 15th century, but the woodwork, the tiles, and the plaster carvings are all made by current artisans from Fez, Morocco.
The idea was to create this Islamic space, to show the living traditions of the Islamic world, and also to create an area where you don't have to look at anything, you don't have to read a label, you can sit on the bench, relax, look at the fountain.
And ruminate on what you've seen so far. Now, given how politicized Islam has become in the United States since 9/11, how did the huge team that put this installation together over nearly a decade engage with that political reality? Haider, who was raised in New Delhi by a Hindu mother and a Muslim father, says at first Met curators and planners lived only in the world of pure scholarship. But they also realized after a while that everyone would come to the museum with their own experiences of the world. Haider does hope people will be able to experience the beauty of each object for itself.
And hopefully sense that each of these objects has the power to take them way, way beyond their present moment. And the totality of them can take them absolutely to another place.
But she hopes they will also understand something deeper about cultures, interconnection, and complexity.
The same person who wakes up in the morning, reads the paper, has a certain idea about his world, can come in here and be offered a wider and deeper perspective. I think more than anything else, we have great faith in the collection itself. We believe in its power, and I personally feel that never has this collection had more power and meaning than now. And I have full confidence that anyone who comes with an open mind and open heart will take a lot back home with them that they didn't have when they first arrived.
But if there is one message, she says, it's that the heritage of the Islamic world is the heritage of everyone. Whether you approach it from Spain or Iran or Turkey or from India, however you find your way in, she says, welcome to the beautiful world of these objects. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
You'll find photos of the galleries at npr.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for the 4th of November, 2011. It was on this date, 1825, the Erie Canal was completed, connecting Lake Erie to the Hudson River, 363 miles from Albany to Buffalo, 40 feet wide, 4 feet deep. It cut transportation costs by about 90%. The world's first deep-level underground tube railway opened in London on this date in 1890, the City and South London Railway Line. The tunnels were round, which gave the railway the nickname it still has today, the Tube. It's the birthday of Charles